Welcome to the C Word, the Conservatives podcast. Today we're talking about musical instruments.
I'm Liz Hebert, a paintings conservator based in Amsterdam in the Netherlands.
I'm Fedra Kumadromu, a conservator of antiquities based in Nicosia, Cyprus.
Oh, gosh, sorry to interrupt. Just before we get on with the episode, I just really wanted to butt in and say that you've only got a few more days when this episode drops to nominate yourself or someone you know for the Marsh Conservation Awards this year. This is your chance, guys. The deadline is, I think, midnight on Sunday, the 2nd of June. 2024, so there's not an awful lot of time. The award categories this year are for heritage conservation in action, research in conservation, innovation in conservation, environmental or sustainability focus in conservation, early career conservators, and outstanding student conservators. There's so much there that you can just dive in and think of projects you've done recently that would fit those categories, or, you know, people that you know that really stand out. Get in there, get nominating. This is your chance. The prize for a winner in each category is £500 and a cool factor, of course. I mean, who doesn't want to say that they won an award? Aside from that, there's, you know, a fancy award ceremony and stuff like that at Icons Conference this year. Which brings me to my second thing that I have to mention, and that's that the C Word is going to be at the Icon Conference this year. So at Icon 24, we will be there. We're going to be asking you some interesting questions, and we'll be there with some swag and some other stuff. We would love to talk to you. If you're there, come say hi. We will be somewhere fairly obvious, probably wearing t-shirts or badges of some description that lets you know that it's us. Yeah, we're really excited to see you guys. I hope to see you there. You can also participate online. Tickets are still on sale. Go check out the Icon website for that. I'm so sorry. I interrupted just before Jonathan introduced himself. Sorry, Jonathan, there you go.
And I'm Jonathan Santa Maria Bouquet, and I'm Senior Conservator for Heritage Collections in the University of Edinburgh in Scotland.
What brought you to Edinburgh? Was it your research or?
I came here to do a PhD. About the first year after I arrived, I got hired as a conservator and I just stayed. It's been many, many years now.
You currently work at the St. Cecilia's Musical Instrument Museum and Concert Hall. Were you hired there, or were you hired in a previous project before then? Or did the museum exist?
So since Cecilia's as a museum has existed for many years now, there's always been a collection of musical instruments. Since the 19th century, there's been a collection of musical instruments in the university. We have had a museum of musical instruments for a long, long time. There was actually two museums. One that was the Reed Concert Hall, the Reed Collection of Musical Instruments, which was a very broad scope collection. And then there was St. Cecilia's Poland Museum that was mostly keyboard instruments. And it was in 2014 that we closed both museums and then we unite them into one single museum, like all of our collections under one roof. So I started the PhD here in 2012. I started as a fellow, so I was working in theory one day a week for my fellowship with the collections as a conservator. But then I was hired as a conservator of musical instruments, and I've been working like that for many, many years. But last year, my role changed, and now I'm the senior conservator of heritage collections. So I no longer deal only with the instruments. I deal with most of the collections at the university. I am leading a small team of mighty conservators of different disciplines. In a way, I'm still dealing with the musical instruments. I'm still the main responsible for that collection, but I'm also responsible for a team of conservators.
How do you see the musical instruments fitting in with the larger collection at your institution?
We are under the big umbrella of the library and university collections. So on one side, we have rare book collections, we have archives, we have the anatomy collection, we have the geology collection, and then there's the musical instruments collection. For a long, long time, the musical instrument collection was part of the music department, so we were independent from all the other collections. But a while ago, there was a merger in which we became part of the special collections of the university. We are the public-facing part of our collections. We have a museum that is open to the public 5 days a week. It's free to visit in Edinburgh, and we have a very active set of activities. We have concerts, we have demonstrations, we have conferences.
Oh, wonderful.
So yeah, it's a very, very dynamic place. Other sides of the heritage collections are like special books, rare books and archives, and they are open for researchers. We're accessible for researchers around. But St. Cecilia's is special because it really is a public facing side of the university. So we have lots of outreach activities that other parts of the university don't really have. So it's a little bit of a crazy space that there's always something interesting going on.
Oh, that's great. That's how a museum should be.
So I was a student at the University of Edinburgh myself, and I was a volunteer at St. Cecilia's Museum for my final year. And there were always such great activities for kids. There were really amazing concerts. I remember a sea shanty concert, which was a lot of fun.
Was a great one.
I wanted to say, actually, Jonathan, you are the first conservator that I have ever met. I was peeking through your lab as many times as I could. It was during my final year in archaeology, and I was thinking about conservation and but more in the archaeological aspect of it. But being able to look at your work on a weekly basis and look at the treatments you do and how you're involved in other aspects within the museum was definitely something that inspired me to enter the field myself.
That's really nice, very sweet. My studio is actually on display, so people can always see what's going on inside. So yes, there's a lot of people that kind of can see what I'm doing inside. I think Fedra was like that, like just looking from the window in my little fishbowl.
Whenever I encounter conservators that work in fishbowls, I always want to ask about what's that experience like? How do you feel that it affects your work as a conservator, or does it at all?
At the beginning, I was worried about it. Mm. It's a weird feeling to have eyes on you when you're doing something as delicate as the things we do. But at the same time, I think people are fascinated to see the backstage, that something that they don't really get.
Yeah.
A good friend of mine gave a paper a few years ago in the American Musical Instrument Society. No, in the SIMSIM, the ICOM Committee for Musical Instruments. And one of the main things that a study of their audiences, the results showed that one of the favorite things of the visitors was watching people doing stuff. And I think that's true in my little fishbowl. People are just fascinated to see someone doing something. I'm giving a little presentation on Wednesday for the public about conservation, about musical instruments, and so on. And people have been submitting questions in advance.
Yeah.
And one question that we received several times is like, is that studio real?
Were you a paid actor?
Exactly. Funny enough, though, like there's a lot of admin and a lot of emailing that goes on in conservation. So I think sometimes people are just bored to see me working in my computer. But it's also part of the, when I'm working with reports or with the database and everything, it's often I'm in the computer. It's like, okay, people might be disappointed.
Necessary evil. Well, that's great that it's such a point of contact for the visitors as well.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and then sometimes I get people that will ask the front desk if they can ask me questions, and I'll come out and have a little chat.
Oh, that's great.
I also have to say I have a blind that I can close. If I'm doing something that I need full concentration, I don't want any interruptions, I can close my blinds and shut the display for a little bit. But it doesn't happen very often. I thought I was going to use it much more often.
That's nice. That means you're very comfortable at this point. But I remember also you were in the upper floor sometimes where all your pianos and harpsichords are, and you were tuning all the instruments in front of visitors as well.
Yeah, that's right. We, as I said before, we are a dynamic collection. We do keep a portion of our instruments functional, and we use them. We use them for concerts, for presentations, for in-gallery tours. And of course, that means maintenance. And maintenance, it's easier for me to come to the instrument than bringing the instrument to me. So yes, lots of the tuning, voicing, regulating happens in galleries. One thing that also we got many people asking is, how many times do I tune an instrument? And it's a very tricky question, because some instruments I don't tune very often, but others I'm constantly tuning. And it depends a little bit on the program of the concerts, but also I have a maintenance regime. That means I keep going one instrument at a time. And it's a little bit like myth of painting the bridge on top of the third or fourth. Like when you finish painting one side, you need to start over, because it's a never-ending story. And that's true with the instruments. Like once I finish tuning one gallery, I need to start over again, and so on.
Yeah, very circular workflow.
Really is, mm-hmm. Yeah.
How did you learn how to tune all of the instruments? Were you taught by a previous instruments conservator, or did you learn from somebody who works with those instruments in their, either as an artist or as someone else who creates instruments?
I believe conservation is a fascinating discipline, because we are always learning. We just cannot stop learning. So I started my career as a musician. And
oh, really? What instrument?
I used to play double bass, but I was really bad.
Oh, wonderful.
I'm a retired musician. So studying music gave me the language and the know-how of what is it that I want to accomplish. What is the repertoire, the history of music, the history of the instruments. So that's one side of things. And there's a lot of theory there. Then I'm really fascinated with the tuning systems and temperaments and so on. And it's a world on its own. It's a whole rabbit hole.
Yeah, in a world that isn't limited to conservation either. I'm sure that there are papers, musical theory, that get written about like completely different fields.
Absolutely, absolutely. When I started in St. Cecilia, there was an assistant curator, John Raymond, and he was he still is a very, very knowledgeable human being. Like he was the main caretaker of those instruments for 30 years. So he knew them all very well, and he had very, very specific ideas and theories about all of them. So I learned a lot just from him. And he was extremely generous, extremely generous. We would spend hours and hours and hours tuning and talking about tuning and so on. So it's a long process. And then after that, I've kept learning, and I keep dialogue with other conservators and with other musicians. I was just the other day talking about that with a colleague about temperament and why using one temperament instead of the other. And it's very fascinating.
Can you say what is temperament in the way that you're...
It's a can of worms. It's really hard to explain in simple terms, but basically when we tune anything in musical terms, whenever there's a sound in nature, the sound is produced because there's a vibration of air, and this air produces waves.
Mm-hmm.
And the different notes are portions of these waves and ratios between them. So a ratio of 2 to 1 is an octave. So when we say an octave that is between C and C is the repetition of the same note, but at double the frequency. And then in between these two notes, we can divide with as many notes as we want, as many sounds as we want. Different cultures have different ways of breaking that portion of waves. And the Western world had decided that it's 12 semitones, 12 half steps. This is a somewhat arbitrary decision, but there are some notes that are related to the ratio again. So we say 1 to 2 is an octave, but then 3 to 4 is a fifth, 4 to 5 is a fourth, and so on. So there's notes that fall in between these beautiful waves. But the nature of these waves is that if we follow them in a continuum, because there are fractions of these waves, you end up with a mathematical discrepancy.
Oh, okay.
Discrepancy is usually called comma. And basically a temperament is a way to hide this comma between notes.
Okay. So it's like making allowances between notes in order to even it out.
It's a compromise. Yeah. So for many, 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 many centuries, we've tried to figure out what to do with this comma. And different time periods and different places have come with different solutions. That discrepancy gets divided in 12 equal parts, and all the notes get one of these 12 portions. What happens is then all of them are out of tune. So we are used to music that is absolutely out of tune. We've been listening for so long, it sounds good.
So when you have to conserve an instrument from and you're trying to get it to be representative of a specific time period within its history, are you then using the temperament from that time period and that culture?
Exactly. Exactly. So depending on the time period the instrument was built, but also depending on where it was built, and also depends on what's the repertoire that someone's going to play with it.
Yeah.
So I need to figure out which is the temperament that we should use and decide, often with the musician, what do we do with this temperament? And it's fantastic. To be honest, listening to music with the proper temperament is a completely different experience, an absolute different experience. And composers back then were writing in specific keys because they knew that these discrepancies were going to be more or less evident. Mm. So, for example, when Bach would write a piece in C minor sounds absolutely out of tune. It sounds horrendous. But that dissonance was intended to make you feel uncomfortable. So usually pieces in C minor are tense. They're meant to be tense. They're meant to be uncomfortable.
That is so cool.
Yeah, that is amazing.
So nowadays we listen to pieces that can be in any key and they sound more or less the same, just a little higher or low. But back then they had a completely different feeling and a different language. So it's very, very satisfying to get that little detail that makes the music sound much, much nicer.
So the instruments that are playable and that are used in the concert hall, do you discuss with the artist every time? Depending on what kind of music and what epoch of music they will be playing?
Yeah, talk about temperament. I'm imagining that working with musicians is very similar to working with artists.
Yes. Yeah, we have many stakeholders and we need to try to keep everyone happy. the good thing is that I don't live in an island. Like, I'm part of a team. That's really good. So usually the first approach from the musician tends to be to the curator, and the curator has a first chat with the musician as to what's the repertoire that this person wants to play, and then we kind of give some options of what would be the most appropriate instrument that we have. And then usually once they decide, then I get the email saying, like, well, they're suggesting this instrument, what do you think? And I go, yeah, maybe we have this other one because that one has been played too many times. Or we say, like, oh yeah, fantastic. That's perfect for that. And then the next step is like, all right, is this person playing by itself or is playing with a group of music of all other instruments? That will change a lot. There are instruments that you can retune, but others are harder. So like if there's a harpsichord and a lute, it's fine. The lute can always adapt. But if it's something more like a flute or like some woodwinds or brass, it's a little harder to adapt. Because apart from the temperament, we also have different pitch, which means the A is not always being the same sound universally. So I need to decide also which A, which pitch we're going to use. So that's usually a conversation with the musician. And sometimes there's compromise and sometimes the musician adapts to what we can offer. I mean, there's always a limit for everything. My favorite word in everything that I do is balance. Finding the right balance, I think, is the key for everything that I do. And this is one of the examples, like the balance between the instrument and the musician, the temperament, the tuning, all of that needs to be good, harmonious balance. And then we're all happy.
Good approach.
So do you sometimes have to deny an instrument for an artist? Do you sometimes have artists asking to play a specific instrument and you have to tell them, no, that's not possible?
Yes. Yes, definitely. Yeah. No, fortunately, it doesn't happen too often. But there are instruments in our collection that are very, very popular and very famous. So if we say yes to every time, that poor instrument will be playing the whole time. There's one particular harpsichord that it was made by Tascan, and it's a very interesting instrument because it was one of the first instruments that was a full set of technical drawings for that were available for makers, researchers, and so on. So when the early music revival happened, most instrument makers that were trying to make copies of harpsichords, they got a copy of this technical drawing and they make copies. So this instrument has been copied and copied and copied and copied for the last 100 years. So most people that learn to play the harpsichord, they learn in a copy of our instrument. And most schools that offer harpsichord as one of their specialties, they have a copy of our instrument. So everybody wants to come and play the original because it's like the holy grail of the harpsichord. Don't get me wrong, it's really good. But we have another two instruments from more or less the same period with very, very similar characteristics that could be played just as well for the same repertoire. So we often try to steer the musicians in one direction or the other and try to keep a good balance because, I mean, yes, we offer this dynamic object, but it's a historical object and we are still supposed to preserve it. You know, it's the whole paradox for us is to play or not to play, to play and preserve. Mm-hmm. And function is anathema to preservation. And if we just keep playing, we're going to end up with no instrument. But at the same time, we do understand that there is the all inherent cultural heritage to this object that it's only achieved through function and play.
Yeah.
So to, again, find a nice balance and try and compromise. And I mean, we are in the business of forever. We are preserving forever. And forever is a long time. And we always say that we preserve all these objects for the future, for future generations. But I'm also of the idea that we are also the future.
They need to be enjoyed now.
Mm-hmm.
Exactly. So
I think that's important. Is that the leading school of thought amongst instrument conservation right now?
Yes and no. We've been talking about this solidly for the last 40 years. There's many publications for and many publications against. Some institutions are more lenient than others. I think we are on the side of allowing this instrument to be performed. But again, not all of them, not all the time.
Yeah.
Just good balance. We have a protocol that we follow every time one of our instruments is used. And yes, by allowing the function of these historical objects, we make a conscious decision of where, and that with wear comes maintenance and strings will break and electro will stop working and it will need more intrusive maintenance if you want.
I'm curious. So one of our other hosts, Chloe, she works at a museum where they preserve banners. So it's all tapestries that were used during protest in the 1800s, in the 20th century, etc. But one of the things that she's talked about is that these pieces were actively being used by the communities that owned them. And so they would get, you know, different pieces torn off and replaced. I'm sure that that is true in instrument conservation as well, especially I would imagine more with wood instruments, something that can be adapted. Do you see that mm-hmm. when you're conserving pieces?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I love musical instruments because they are storytellers. Like they're, I always think of these objects as three-dimensional documents. Like the information is there, you just need to read it, and different approaches, different people will have a different reading of the same object. Often you can see like a whole story or a whole progression of things that happen to a single object, how music changed or fashion changed, and then the object is being adapted to this new trend, new fashion, new sounds, new music, new strings. It's fantastic. And everything is there if you know how to read it. I really like to see the human story through the object. It's just fascinating, absolutely fascinating. And often one of the questions and that it's I don't want to say romanticized, but it is kind of like one of these existential questions is when you're working with one of these and it's like, what's my right to be inserting myself in the story of of this, how much eventually this is also part of, I am part of the story of this thing by physically working on it. And it's, I think it's humbling because some of them are 400 years old. And then, of course, now there is 12 years of my life that has been invested in that. And in a way, someone in the future might be able to read that portion of its life through what I did, which I think is fascinating and humbling and exciting all at the same time.
I think you speak for the larger conservation field as well. That was very well put.
If you've had to do a heavy treatment, for example, consolidation treatments onto an instrument, would it have changed the playability and the quality of the sound of the instrument to a point where it can no longer be used?
Yeah, for example, like, do you have to consider how dense a glue is?
So there are, yeah, well, I guess as any conservator, I have a collection of different adhesives for different treatments with different degrees of hardness, but also different media to for retreatability purposes and so on.
Yeah, it just adds a whole other like layer of considerations into selecting your adhesives.
In the world of violins that are in the, not in museums, but that are out there in the world, like the famous Stradivari violins, Guarneri, that are played by musicians in orchestra. Those instruments have been modified and opened and reopened and restored many, many times for them to maintain this functionality regardless of anything. It's like play. All of these instruments have been so modified that they cannot sound like they sounded originally. And there's just no way to bring the time back. Like that's one reality. And nowadays restorers are really good. Some of them are fantastic. Like the people that work commercially with violins are just they have treatments that are absolutely astonishing. And one of the first thing they do is remove everything that has been done before, because often it was done poorly. And one thing that we used to use to close cracks on wood is you put a little bit of a cleat, a wooden cleat, to close So that cleat will change the density of that portion, and you will create a little node of vibration, but it will vibrate differently than everything else. And some violins are completely covered of those. Now, from my museum side of things, that's fantastic because that's a history map that I can read. From a musician point of view, that's just impeding the thing to actually work properly. So you usually gets removed, which is a loss. It's, you're losing history to gain, but it's a sound that is no longer the original sound. You're getting a new sound.
What are the properties specifically that you're looking for when you're selecting an adhesive for consolidation purposes?
It depends what I'm doing. So some parts of the instrument are kind of meant to be treated several times. Like, again, going back to violins, the back of the violin and the front of the violin, they it's better if they're not super strong glues, because it's better if you can actually reopen easily without damaging the wood. But if you have a crack on the soundboard, you want something that is going to be strong and stable, but also very elastic. So you want something that will move with the wood. In my world and my work, I rather have that crack reopen than creating a crack elsewhere, which is something that happens very often. When you put these cleats, you create such a strong bond, but the wood wants to move. So it cannot move there, so it moves elsewhere, and you create a new crack. So by closing a fracture, you're creating one or two more. So I want, in my practice, I want an adhesive that if the wood needs to move and it needs to open, I want that fracture to reopen rather than create a new fracture. And then the third part is solubility. Like if I need to retreat this adhesive, if it's on the soundboard, I don't want to ruin the varnish. So I cannot use something that I will require a solvent that might also damage the varnish. And so again, it's all a matter of balance. And unfortunately, there's not one thing fits all. Like you need to adapt. These instruments are dynamic and they're moving and they're changing and so on. And in the time that I've worked for this museum, we have had to declare one of our harpsichord as no longer playable, an instrument that was playable when I arrived and that is no longer playable. And it was not to do with treatments. It was just the tension of the strings moved the wood in such a way that it just was too much. Everything can be fixed. I'm sure, like, if you give me enough time and resources, I could have returned functionality. But at what cost? Is that, am I being too intrusive? Am I, like, really, like, forcing this thing to play, even if the natural progression is for it to not play anymore? Like, how far do we go? How intrusive do we go? And I think in that case, that the answer was, that's enough. Like, the treatment would have been too intrusive to the point that I would be losing more than I would be gaining by doing this treatment. It's lived 300 years. We have recordings. Let's be happy about it. The instrument's still there. So it's good still for research. It's still good for understanding how it's constructed. It's like all the measurements are still there. People can come and make copies. And then a copy sometimes is the best way to restore playability to an object.
You've mentioned copies a few times now. Can you walk me through, is a copy the same as a reconstruction? How is it differ, or is it the same?
We have still today many, many musicians that play all repertoire with instruments that are appropriate for that time, but we don't have enough instruments, original instruments for everyone, and not all of the original instruments are in good shape for it to be played by anyone. So if you're a musician that plays Baroque music and you require a harpsichord, your best way to go is to get a copy or a reproduction of an original instrument. Now, how do you do that? It varies a lot depending on who's the maker. So one thing that we do as a museum is we provide access for researchers and makers to come and see the objects closely. So people will come and make drawings of these objects, take measurements, try to see the inside, to see how they're built. There are people that make exact copies of our objects, and that's one approach. Another approach is to try and copy the instrument as it was, not as it is. Mm. And to do that, you really need to do a lot of research. What was the original? Because most of them have been modified one way or the other.
In terms of sounds that we don't have on record, how could you know what an instrument would have originally sounded like? How can you make sure that the recreation of that sound is accurate?
It's impossible. There is just no way around it. Like, the sound of the 15th century is gone, and we won't get it back. Like, the closest you get is to play with our instruments that are still there, but those instruments have been changing structurally and even molecularly for the last 300 years. It's not gonna sound like it was. But also, our ears are not what the ears of the 15th century or 17th century people.
Their ears were much better.
Around us has changed. Like, now we have cars and
a lot of ambient noise,
air conditioning and all that, and we don't have the clip-clop of the horse in the street. Like it, everything has changed so much. So, like, it's not just the object. Everything, and even how we perceive music, because now we have different comparative ideas that before they didn't exist. But one way that we can approach it is, again, trying to make a very accurate reproduction of how the instrument was, and then wish for the best. Like, I in my spare time, I make lutes, and I'm very passionate about my instrument. And I part, when I'm trying to make an instrument, I part from the idea, from a sound that I already have in my head of how do I want it to sound. Am I right? I don't know. It's just, we are all human. We create our universe. So I try to get there, but I'm going back to the other question. When I make a lute, I usually don't make a copy of a specific instrument. I try to make a reinterpretation of all the lutes that I know of that same period, kind of like merge it together. So I'm not reinventing the wheel, but I'm also not copying this one instrument that might have been the worst instrument that that guy ever made. The, but I also know people that make exact copies that that go to the, like, even copy the little blemishes in the varnish of.
Oh, wow.
It depends on what's your outcome. What is it that you want to achieve?
Interesting.
Would you ever consider making a virtual library of the St. Cecilia Museum instrument sounds?
Absolutely, yes. We started with that, and it's a project that is still very much alive. We're still trying to figure out funding to do it. We're making a library of sound. So what we had was a group of specialists that recorded individual sounds of one instrument and all sorts of different ways. So like long notes, short notes, with staccato, without staccato, like all these different sounds. And we have these as a library of sounds that then can be used to reproduce music online. We have some of that, those data sets. We would like to do a way larger data set of those. First of the instruments that actually play, because it's easier. But eventually it will be nice to try and recreate models of the ones that don't play anymore.
Would that be open access? Could composers use those virtual libraries and compose a piece of music with them?
Yes, the idea is yes, for it to be absolutely open access.
My partner would be very happy to hear that because he's a composer himself and he was volunteering many times at St. Cecilia's himself.
Oh, I'm sure that you, working with instruments, are often encountering materials like wood and metals, but are there any techniques that you can think of that are hyper-specific to instrument conservation that other conservators might not be aware of?
I often find the opposite to be the case. Like I am known in within our field because I used all sorts of techniques from all the other disciplines. So I use a lot of
like
paper conservation techniques. I apply them to music and instruments. And people are like, well, yeah, like conservation is conservation. Like I use stone paper and Japanese paper all the time. Yeah, I use textile conservation techniques for a bunch of things. So I try to do the other way around. Like I try to borrow techniques and materials from all sorts of places.
Hi, everyone. It's Liz, letting you know that there's 15 extra minutes of this interview up on Patreon, including John's personal museum recommendations and a very interesting conversation about the motivation to collect musical instruments. Bonus content like this and more is available on Patreon for as little as $1 or pound per month.
This is Solange here. I recently met a violin maker and repairer who lives in Sheffield, within walking distance of my own studio. So I went to go and see her. You're Emma Hardy.
Yep.
And you're a violin maker?
I am. So a maker and repairer. So I do a mixture of both.
Was it violin making, the course that you did?
It was making, and then I enrolled on a proper course in South London that's making and repair. So you do both, and that's 3 years of training.
And were you most drawn to the making or the repair or both?
I'd say the making comes more easily to me. I'm a bit more, have a brain for making. And then the repair stuff, for ages, I actually really pushed against and didn't really do any of it. And then it did just eventually grab me. I think once you understand more of it and learn a bit more about having to treat each individual violin as a different story, look at what people have done beforehand, and then think about your context and all that, that felt more interesting to me than just sort of when you're just learning about the technical aspect of the repairs. Also then talking to the musician and finding out about what they want to use it for, and you know, there's a lot of different factors to weigh up.
When you're repairing a violin, what's the relationship between the final sound and the repair process?
So every violin has a very different sound, and that's impacted by a lot of different things. And there are some repairs that you do that will affect the sound positively or negatively. Cracks are a really common one. Fixing the crack helps the sound if you do it properly, because the crack buzzes and causes all sorts of problems when it's there. But then other things like neck projections. Recently I had a customer in who's the angle that the violin neck is at.
Yeah.
This bit is a set angle, ideally, mm-hmm. that is designed to create a nice amount of tension, which causes more or less pressure on the belly of the instrument. So Baroque instruments used to have a much lower neck angle.
Mm-hmm.
And then when we introduced steel strings, we raised the neck projection. And this customer, her violin had a very low neck angle and very wide, what we call C-bouts, which is sort of the waist of a violin, which meant that she was having some problems with the bowing because her bow was sort of hitting the side of the instrument.
Mm.
Ideally, the fix would be raise the neck projection.
Mm.
But she really liked the sound of her violin.
Mm.
And so it would, in all likelihood, change the sound of it. So we had to have a big discussion about it might change the sound or it might not, and you might like it or you might not, but you know, I can't really guarantee we'll even be able to put it back the way it was. And in that situation, it's almost maybe better for her to just find another violin.
Mm.
You know, if that one could, somebody else could use it for the context that they need it in.
Mm.
Sometimes it's almost better, because you could say in that instance, well, yeah, you could make changes to that instrument, but if she could find another violin that's already set up the way she wants it, it's maybe better not to mess with it.
Yeah.
So it depends. And also that will depend on if it's a more modern one, maybe that matters less. If it's an older, more historical one, you really don't want to be messing with those very much.
Yeah.
If you can help it. There was a sort of era when violins were chopped and changed a lot, and now we sort of just have pieces of what would have been quite historically important instruments that are kind of a bit Frankenstein-y. So it's become much more of a thing now to try and be minimally invasive.
Well, where do you sort of see yourself on the spectrum between sort of restoration and conservation?
I think it's that question changes depending on the violin in front of you, absolutely.
Mm.
So if, for example, you have a 300 or 400-year-old violin that doesn't sort of technically have any problems, you know, it doesn't have any cracks and things like that, but it's maybe not working quite right for the player. You know, I personally wouldn't mess around with the neck angle, or I wouldn't be removing or adding any wood where I could, you know, that with those instruments in mind, you're really prioritizing conservation. But then for maybe instruments that are the last sort of 100 years and a bit more kind of common, then I think it's, in my opinion, totally okay to be prioritizing what the musician needs.
Because I have this with books, you know, because they're an object of use. And I think a lot of conservators are dealing with objects that are not going to be used.
Yeah.
But you do have to think about the person who's going to use them and, weigh that up against how historically important it is.
We have so many instruments that just sit in museums.
Yeah.
And while it's, you know, great that then those have been conserved for future generations to look at and appreciate, it's also quite sad that they're just not played.
Yeah.
You know, they sort of were created to be played. This is why I kind of tend to err on the side of saying I'm a repairer.
Just looking around in your studio, there's so many interesting things I want to ask about. This pot of glue, sort of it looks a bit like animal glue to me, but
the high glue is everything, really, because it's a glue that you can, it's really strong, so it's really good, but you can undo it with warm water or heat. And then so violins are completely constructed using high glue just for that reason, which is why we have violins that are sort of 400 or 500 years old still, because it means that that you can repair them, whereas more modern glues, you just end up taking a load of the wood off, or you know, like guitars are often made with modern glue, and that means that they're harder to repair, and that's why you don't really see so many. Whereas I think now there is a bit of a movement in the guitar world to be more mindful about future preservation of the instrument, but violins are definitely made. Is it one of the reasons that I think it's really important for me to be doing the repair work is that it gives me foresight into, well, what happens to a violin after it's been around for 100 years? What does the wood do after 5, 10, 15 years?
Yeah.
So then when you're making, you can make that in mind, you know?
Yeah.
Like things, just even like the corners always get knocked off.
But that's an interesting point, being a maker.
It really helps
to also be a repairer.
Yeah, absolutely. And you can definitely tell the makers that have never really done any repair work.
So
when you make a violin from scratch, are you aiming for a particular sound, or does that kind of emerge as you're making it, or is it just like a surprise at the end?
It's kind of a mixture of all three of these things, I'd say. So you can make decisions in the making process to try and influence the sound, but ultimately every bit of wood is so different. It is a bit of a kind of unknown until you actually play it. There are a lot of people who spend their whole careers trying to absolutely nail down the science of it and record every tiny thing that they do with the, you know, they record like the wood's density and really, like hammer into the science aspect of it. I'm not totally sold on that as I also just think that even hearing the sound is subjective, and the sound that the violin makes changes depending on the environment, who's playing it, what time of year it is.
Oh boy. Wow.
So you can, things like, you can definitely affect things like whether it's going to be a really powerful instrument. So if it's going to be the kind of instrument that a soloist will play on stage to hit the back of the concert hall versus a much softer, more mellow instrument for the pub. So that, yeah, partly why I kind of prefer to make and then try and find someone to buy it rather than necessarily taking commissions, because people want to know what they're buying. And even getting someone to communicate to you how they're imagining they want the sound is quite difficult.
Yeah.
So
I'm not tone deaf, but I don't have a great ear.
Right.
So I find this whole thing really quite magical and mysterious.
It does definitely take a really long time as well to develop an ear for it. So when I started, every violin kind of sounded the same to me. But now, you know, I can even like the bow that people use is affect the sound of it. So recently I had the violin that I made. I was a bit unsure whether the sound had got a bit woolly, and I was kind of like, does the sound setup need adjusting a bit? And I got one of my friends who's a very good player to have a play on it, and he was sort of like, it sounds okay, but you know, maybe the soundpost needs adjusting. And then all he did was just picked up a different bow and started playing, and I was like, oh, it's the bow.
But then would that bow that you'd originally used sound okay on a different violin?
Yeah, maybe.
Oh,
gosh.
Well, I think it would be really torturous to do what you do if, you know, really liked to be in control.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, so you definitely get, like, violin makers who are engineers and violin makers who are artists.
Yeah.
And there's quite a different approach and ethos to, like, the making and even the restoration as well, to an extent. For both of those kinds of people, and I think I fall more in the artist category, where sure, there is like fundamentals of construction that you absolutely need to be adhering to and need to know, but then I am less interested in trying to really control the outcome and more interested in the process, like to let the character of the wood come out how it wants to, and then you can adjust it.
So just finally, is there anything that you'd like to say about what you do or people to know about?
I guess maybe the importance of it as a thing. I see a lot of people buying instruments online and then they're awful, and then their kids don't like playing them, so then they give up. You know, you sort of always have that thing of parents saying, oh, well, they didn't stick with it. And then you just think, well, of course they didn't stick with it because the violin was awful to play on. And, you know, it's like if you give a kid a bike to ride on and the wheels don't turn. Really, it's a really challenging instrument to learn to play. And you can rent from most repairers if, you know, because I realise not everyone has the budget for a nice violin, but lots of places offer rentals, which are much better value for money and will have been set up properly. People just assume that machines make violins, and actually there aren't machines who can make them properly yet. So all the ones that people are buying from, you know, abroad for 50 quid on Amazon have been made in horrible conditions by humans in factories. So if you think of what,
really depressing.
Yeah, if you think of like a £50 violin, think of how little someone's been paid to make that. There are plenty of options around. You just, there's rental options, and often they're much better value for money. And local councils often have rental systems that are really cheap, and that there are lots of very friendly repairers who are happy to chat to you.
No, thank you. That's such an important point, and I'm really glad we finished on that.
You're welcome.
Thank you so much, Emma.
Thank you.
This has been just delightful.
I really enjoyed interviewing Emma, and One thing that we didn't actually talk about in the interview, but I want to mention now, is that Emma has made and donated a beautiful and decoratively carved violin to a group called Foku Rome. And they're a group of musicians and craftspeople who champion and preserve outdoor folk traditions. And there's actually a documentary called Foku Rome, which is coming out later this year, all about this project. I'm going to leave you now with a clip of one of the folks who roam, Rosie Butler Hall, playing on this violin.
Thanks for listening. We're The C Word, and you've been listening to Liz, Fedra, and Jonathan today. Join us next time for an episode about new museums. In the meantime, you can check out our website at thecword.show, go find us on social media, we're on almost everything, or simply email us on thecwordpodcast@gmail.com. The intro and outro music is Spring by Didi Misik, used under a Creative Commons Attribution License, with additional music and sound effects by Callum Robertson. As usual, this has been a Wooden Dice production.